You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
My name is Greg Jackson. I'm a PhD holding historian, a professor, and the creator of History That Doesn't Suck, a podcast that makes legit, seriously researched American history come to life through entertaining stories. Join me for a chronological telling of the United States story, from the Revolution to fractious Civil War, tenacious inventors, brave reformers, and more. With more than 100 episodes, you can already binge listen your way from 1776 to the early 20th century. Listen to History That Doesn't Suck on Spotify.
Today's show is brought to you by our supporters on Patreon, including our Commodore class. That's Commodores Obvious, Blood Groove, Torso and Pinches, Ironside, MD, Scuttlebutt, Hartman, Gingrich, Clan Roland, Big Beard, Willie P., Schmarls, Proctor, Chairboat, Long Knives Logan, Cannon Monkey, Axios, Pitlock, Jack of the South Seas, Lost Again, The Navigator, Governor Roop, Gin-Soaked Jim, Workman, Rum Runner, Skipper, Sawbones, Hefe, Bull, Vertigon, Rumgut, and Bootstraps Bailey. And of course our quartermasters, Hunter, Buddy, Heather, Howard, and Crimson Davy Thunder. And I'd like to welcome our newest patrons, Ace Tie Pilot, Chuck Wagon Gamer, and Samantha, as well as our newest Commodores, Elias and Cameron. Hello. Welcome to the Pirate History Podcast. My name is Matt. Thank you for listening. It would be difficult to overstate the effect that the capture of the Ganji Sawai in September 1695 had on the world. That act of piracy against the Mughal pilgrim fleet shook the entire world to its foundations. I mean, already it was a time of strife and conflict and war. There was fierce fighting from America to Vietnam. Anywhere that French forces could be found, they were likely to be engaged by English or Dutch or both forces. Despite what could easily be called a world war, England diverted resources and manpower, and they organized an extensive global manhunt for pirates. Resources and time that could have been put to winning the war, but Henry Avery's piracy threatened everything. The problem is, though, nobody could find them. Fancy was a ghost ship. She was like an apparition that disappeared into the mists of a dark, moonlit sea, never to be seen again. This is episode 232. Timothy Tugbutton and Simon Whifflingpin at the Bank of Aldgate Pump. Of course, the Fancy was not a ghost ship. She was a very real ship, crewed by living men and led by a captain who was pretty clever. The last time we caught up with the Fancy was in the Comoros Islands, just northwest of Madagascar. That's where the three ships remaining in the fleet finally got down to the business of splitting up the loot. That's Fancy, Portsmouth Adventure, and Pearl. The Dolphin had been burned at sea a few weeks earlier, and Amity was ashore at St. Mary's. Now, all three of those ships had cargo aboard, but it wasn't yet divvied up equally, because there were different kinds of plunder. You know, the Pearl, for example, might be full of pearls. Portsmouth Adventure might have nothing but spices and silk, and Fancy might have all of the hard specie, all of the gold and silver. No, that's not how it broke down, but the point is they didn't have time to split it up in equal monetary amounts while they were busy looting the Mughal treasure fleet. You carry whatever you can carry and get it on board one of your ships as fast as possible. But in the Comoros, as they were splitting up their treasure, that's when the men of Pearl, handing Every's men their own share, were accused of clipping coins. This is the event that led to that almost violent encounter between the Fancy and the Pearl. But I'm suspicious that this whole event might be a bit made up, or maybe misrepresented. It's possible that the men of the Fancy were trying to fatten their own pockets at the expense of the Pearl, that they made the whole thing up and used their superior numbers to just take the cargo from the Pearl pirates. But it's also possible that this event never happened at all. See, a little bit down the road, the surgeon from the Pearl is going to get picked up by the authorities in Jamaica. He's going to stand trial, but he'll get acquitted. He got off largely because of his entirely believable story about kidnapping and forced servitude, a story that might even have been true. But really it was the lack of evidence that he'd done anything wrong. See, he was a surgeon, but he was not a rich man. He had no plot of land, no slaves, just a humble little barber surgery in Kingston, servicing sailors and farm laborers. He's not the kind of guy who would have a huge cache of silver stashed away somewhere. That surgeon told the court in Kingston that he would have been paid off, even though he had been kidnapped. That was the deal. You have to serve us, but you will get a cut. But Henry Every took all of their money, so he didn't get anything. But then, a few months later, when several of the crew of the Fancy were on trial in London, the prosecution asked them if this was true. And the accused pirates told the court that yes, Captain Every did take all the shares of the Pearl, which was entirely Captain Henry Every's decision. We didn't have anything to do with it. You find him and you've got your culprit. And it is a believable story. Maybe the Fancy did take all their money, and maybe this surgeon was just an unwitting participant in their voyage, but I kind of can't shake the possibility that these pirates realized that their old companion had pulled a bit of a con. That maybe he did have a sea chest hidden away in some lonely cove on the coast of Jamaica filled with silver and jewels. And that thanks to this pretty believable story, it looked like he was going to get away with it. Now these pirates were, well, they weren't in great shape, but maybe they realized that maybe he was going to get away with it if they played along. You know, say you and your younger brother were both in trouble for taking some cookies from the cookie jar, but you have chocolate on your fingers. The noble thing to do is to fall on your sword, to take the blame and let your little brother get away with it. The Pearl put in at St. Augustine Bay with virtually no treasure to their name. Now, the men of the Portsmouth Adventure, they did get a share, maybe not as big a share as they had been expecting, but the Fancy had a pretty persuasive argument there. I mean, look at all of our big guns and all of these men carrying sabers and pistols. All of those murderous pirates standing on the deck, well, they were the people who went toe-to-toe with the Mughal ship, the men who won that battle. Are you going to tell that crew of violent murderers that you want more of the money that they earned by fighting and bleeding on the deck of the Ganji Sawai? Probably not, but the Portsmouth Adventure still got some money, so they didn't complain too loudly. Now it's about this time that Portsmouth Adventure was blown ashore, and when Fancy took about half of her crew, including Captain Farrow, on board. The best source I've seen on the division of the plunder comes from The Trial of Joseph Dawson, Edward Forsyth, William May, William Bishop, James Lewis, and John Sparks at the Old Bailey for Felony and Piracy, October 19, 1696. Not a catchy title, but accurate. It reads, and it's a transcription, so it reads kind of like a play. It's got their names in front of the quote. Mr. Justice Turton, what number of persons were aboard when the dividend was made? Philip Middleton, about 160. Turton, what might the shares be? Middleton, some £1,000, some £600, £500, and some less, according as the company thought they deserved. Now that's not the equal shares for equal work that we have come to expect from the pirates. And it gets worse. Middleton goes on to tell the court that he only got £100, according to the will of the company, and even that £100 was stolen by one of the other pirates on board. Now, from other sources, we know that Henry Every actually walked away with £2,000, but we can assume that some of the other officers on board, say, Joseph Dawson, Henry Adams, maybe even Joseph Farrow, the captain of the Portsmouth Adventure and the quartermasters of the Fancy, they probably got £1,000 each. Beyond that, though, we could only speculate how much any particular pirate got, outside of the testimonies of all of those men on trial. 500 a man seems to have been the share handed out to most of the men. There was also hazard pay of £100 extra to those who were injured. I do, though, wonder what Philip Middleton did to earn only £100 sterling. Was he a coward in battle? Did he owe somebody money, or was he lying about his share? These are questions about which we could speculate wildly, and many people have. There have been no few treasure hunters in the West Country of England, with metal detectors in hand, searching for the buried treasure of these fancy pirates. Regardless, once the plunder was distributed, Fancy sailed off into the sunset. And what happens after gets kind of muddy. What we have is a trail of clues put together after the fact, though they do seem to paint an accurate picture of what the Fancy was up to after the raid. Some of the pieces could be missing, some of the pieces could be incorrect. The problem is, Henry Every and his officers all used aliases, and they did so mostly in non-English ports, so the men who met them had virtually no idea that these even could have been the pirates. But if history is a set of lies agreed upon, this is the agreed-upon lie for Henry Every and the Fancy. Their next stop was the French territory to the southeast of Madagascar. There were three primary French settlements in the region, but Fancy paid a visit probably to only one of them. There was Port Dauphin, on the southeast mainland coast of Madagascar. We'll be seeing a lot more of Port Dauphin in the future, but it's likely the Fancy did not stop off there. Instead, the pirates stopped off at Ile Bourbon. Now, they didn't call the island Ile Bourbon or even Bourbon Island. They called it Saint Apollonia. That's the old Portuguese name for the island, but we don't use either today. Instead, we call it Reunion Island. The name La Réunion came about in the French Revolution, about 100 years after the pirates visited. But we're going to go ahead and call it Reunion Island from here on out, and we're going to be seeing a lot of Reunion Island. It was something of a pirate haven in the Indian Ocean. Not on the level of Libertalia at Madagascar, but not far off, and their proximity was not an accident. You know, the English have this reputation in regard to piracy, and, to be fair, they earned it. But the French are almost as bad. But they don't seem to have the same reputation. Maybe that's just my bias as an English speaker, but I think it's because the French stuck a bit closer to the privateer mold. You know, by and large, they avoided targets that would cause serious diplomatic troubles, and usually, though not always, they avoided other French ships. But I think the real reason that they never earned quite the same reputation is because they don't have a Nassau. No French pirate republic, and to be sure, there were French pirates at the Pirate Republic of Nassau, but it was an English pirate project. And that's going to be the biggest, most momentous explosion of piracy that the world has ever seen. It builds a reputation. But while the English have Port Royal, the French have Tortuga. Where the English have St. Mary's, the French have Reunion Island. Reunion was a prison colony early on, and some of the very first French inhabitants of Reunion Island were mutineers. They were arrested, convicted, and sent to this tiny little island in the Indian Ocean. And for a few years more, the French continued to dump rogue privateers and mutineers and pirates there. This was a punishment, but it also served as kind of a resource for France, maybe a stockpile.
Everybody shush! William Shatner has something to say.
Cat and Jethro, box of oddities.
What do you do when the woman you love dies? Well, of course you dig her up and you live with her.
Aww.
The show examines weird things.
There are plenty of old photographs from this time period of children out in the streets playing in and among the dead horse carcasses.
Oh, I miss those days. Things used to be so much simpler.
Cat and Jethro.
Then there's the urine wheel, which sounds like a really bad game show.
They've done weird things. Cat and Jethro, box of oddities. That is really mysterious.
Join Cat and Jethro Gilligan Toth for the strange, the bizarre, the unexpected, as they lift the lid and cautiously peer inside the box of oddities.
The Webby Award-winning Box of Oddities podcast from Airwave Media.
Napoleon Bonaparte rose from obscurity to become the most powerful and significant figure in modern history. Over 200 years after his death, people are still debating his legacy. He was a man of contradictions, a tyrant and a reformer, a liberator and an oppressor, a revolutionary and a reactionary. His biography reads like a novel, and his influence is almost beyond measure. I'm Everett Rummage, host of the Age of Napoleon podcast, and every month I delve into the turbulent life and times of one of the greatest characters in history, and explore the world that shaped him in all its glory and tragedy. It's a story of great battles and campaigns, political intrigue, and massive social and economic change. But it's also a story about people, populated with remarkable characters. I hope you'll join me as I examine this fascinating era of history. Find The Age of Napoleon wherever you get your podcasts.
After ships rounded the Cape of Good Hope, often they had fewer men than they had started out with. Were that the case, you could always stop off at Reunion Island and pick up, I don't know, half a dozen men who knew their business at sea. You don't want too many criminals on board, but in a pinch they could be useful and maybe earn a pardon. The other benefit to a prison colony, something that the English had figured out with Port Royal, was the plausible deniability it granted. Were, for example, a crew of less than reputable English sailors to show up with a ship full of illicitly obtained goods which they wanted to trade for illegally obtained slaves, well, were that to happen in this hypothetical situation, the French government would be able to almost legitimately claim a complete lack of knowledge or accountability. When ships from, say, Port Dauphin stopped over at Reunion Island and profited off of all of these illegal trades, they didn't know anything about the origin of these goods, and in the end, they paid the French government their due. So when Henry Every showed up at Reunion Island with a ship full of stolen Mughal goods, and when he traded them with the French on Reunion Island for a bunch of slaves, he was indirectly helping to fund the war against England. Now that wasn't the goal, but it was a side effect. Every's goal was simple, and an often under-discussed aspect of pirate lore. He was laundering his money. Most of their shares were made up of hard coin, and those coins were stamped with Mughal markings. But there were also a great deal of trade goods on board, you know, spices and teas and silks and dyes, all of which was just as incriminating as gold and silver. Were they to show up at any English port, or honestly most ports around the world, they would have been arrested. The only loot that wouldn't get them immediately arrested would be raw jewels, not the jewelry. That would have been of a distinctive design, but raw gemstones, pearls and diamonds, mainly. Naturally, they would raise suspicions, especially in the hands of some scruffy sailor, but they weren't damning evidence. But at Reunion Island, the pirates traded a ton of their plunder for slaves. Now, first of all, obviously, that's pretty morally reprehensible, and Henry Avery was happy to engage, but if we put that aside and looked at the financial aspect of this transaction, well, it must have been kind of nerve-wracking for the pirates. Silver coins aren't going to go bad, but human beings can die. And slaves, often kept in completely inhumane conditions on their slave ships, died pretty frequently. But even beyond the money laundering aspect, there was still a financial upside here. These were illegally obtained slaves that were going to be sold on the black market. There was a lot of profit potential in this transaction. So if we were to take Henry Avery's 2,000 pounds sterling and convert it into modern money, according to the British National Archives, it would be worth well over 200,000 pounds. That was equivalent to over 20,000 days' work, or about 60 years for a skilled tradesman. For the average crewman, they were looking at about 75,000 modern American dollars. It wasn't a fortune, but if they budgeted and invested their money wisely, it was enough to set them up for life. Which should have been enough for the pirates of the fancy. But it wasn't. After Reunion Island, the pirates went radio silent. We don't hear anything about them as they round the Cape of Good Hope and sail into the southern Atlantic. Their next stop was at São Tomé, a Portuguese possession popular for picking up supplies on the voyage from South Africa to the West Indies. Which is why the fancy was there. They collected wood and water, they bought wine and foodstuffs, you know, the usual, but they had plenty of money to pay for all of that. And yet, they didn't. Instead of cash or trade, the governor at São Tomé was handed a, quote, bill of exchange drawn on the bank of Aldgate Pump, signed by Timothy Tugmutton and Simon Whifflingpin. End quote. Now, English speakers will probably recognize these instantly as nonsense words, but for a Portuguese-speaking governor, they were less obviously nonsense. Especially because, due to the war, the Portuguese were expected to aid the English in any way possible. This was a scam, yes, but it was also a prank. Both of those names, Timothy Tugmutton and Simon Whifflingpin, were well-known satirical names in 1696. A Tugmutton was a mutton-monger, a butcher, or a meat salesman. And there was actually a little market on the outskirts of London called Tugmutton Common. But it also meant a big fat guy. And there were a ton of big fat guy characters on the London stage in the 1690s named Tugmutton. Similarly, Whifflingpin was a cliche that appears in all sorts of literary examples, most famously in Lewis Carroll's Jabberwocky. So these were big red flags, but the Portuguese did not notice. But then there was Aldgate Pump. Now that's something that some of you will already know about. Aldgate Pump is a real place. It's a very old water pump in London. In its original form, as a well, it dates back to the 1270s. The Aldgate in question was the eastern gate of the city wall of London. And that goes way back, I think, back to Londinium and the Roman Empire in Britain. Traditionally, that eastern gate was the dividing line between central London and eastern London, or the East End. Once that wall was no longer practical, that pump that had previously been just inside the Auld Gate served as the dividing marker before the East End. But more to the point here, an Auld Gate pump was, and might even still today be, an expression that meant a bad check, or, more commonly, a scam. E.T. Fox sums this episode up nicely. He writes, quote, "One is tempted to imagine the smirks which must have crept across the pirates' faces as they loaded their supplies bought with the bill, or the exasperation of the governor when he tried in turn to pass the bill on to an English sea captain, as he tried to explain the joke to the hapless foreigner." End quote. One could take issue with Fox calling the governor of a Portuguese island a foreigner on his own island, but the point does stand. This was a con job, but it was also funny and it was clever. It was the kind of story that, whenever any average Englishman or woman, certainly anybody from London, especially from the East End, when they heard this story, well, they would have had similar smirks. They'd have gotten a chuckle out of it. Just the English pulling the wool over some Portuguese governor's eyes. It would have warmed their hearts just a bit more to Henry Every and his men. The crew of the Fancy, about 160 men at this point, well, they would be set for life. If, that is, they could get away with it. Each of them had about a lifetime's wages in their pocket, and if they could keep it, if they could find a plot of land somewhere, or maybe, if they were so inclined, buy a ship, they might have a very comfortable life indeed. The pirates made one last stop at another island in the South Atlantic to pick up some turtles. It's one of those islands where sea turtles congregate, and the pirates filled their holds. And with that, they were ready to sail across the Atlantic to the West Indies. Next time we will follow the Fancy to the West Indies and begin our look at New Providence Island and Nassau. I would like to thank everybody for listening. I'd like to thank everybody who has helped to support the show, everybody who has signed up to become a patron on Patreon, anybody who has left us ratings or reviews, and everybody who has recommended this show. Without all of you, we wouldn't be able to do this. Thank you. Our theme music was The Old Captain by the fantastic band Brillig. If you haven't checked them out yet, you absolutely should do so. You can find them at brillig.com.au. That's brillig.com.au. After you're done over there, why not check out our website at piratehistorypodcast.com. As always, and most importantly, thank you for listening.
Live on in legend tonight.